And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us here. It's great to be with you once again. It is Saturday evening right here. It's the 4th of January into the new roaring decade, the 20s, of course, 2020s. Great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us. If you're joining us live on DLive, redice.tv, maybe on VK or Twitter, it's great to have you here, no matter how you're tuning in, how you're watching tonight. Special thanks, as always, to all Red Ice members as well. Of course, you guys ensure that we can do shows like this. And, of course, we're going to do a little bit more back to the interviews in 2020 as well. A lot of things queued up, a lot of people I want to have on, and we'll try to balance interviews with some of the shorter videos that we do, and, of course, in addition to both Weekend Warrior and Flashback Friday. And if there's time, hopefully there's time, I'm looking at starting a new segment as well called the No-Go Zone. Where I'm actually going to dive deeper into some of the issues which, you're not supposed to talk about, but also spend a little bit more time on each kind of topic, as both Flashback Friday and Weekend Warrior moves fairly fast through stuff. But anyway, we're gathered here tonight, right, because we got to follow up on what it is that's been happening in Iran. Actually, it happened in Iraq, but the main player, of course, is Iran, that was targeted with Soleimani. And what has happened since the strike and stuff like that. There are some updates. We have Jason Reza Giorgiani with us today to actually talk about this. Helps to break this down for us, because there's a lot of components of this. And, of course, he's very good at the historical aspects. He does have insight into things which I think a lot of people wouldn't have normally. So, Jason, welcome back. It's a long time ago since we spoke. It was well over a year we had you on the show. How's it going, Jason?
It's been way too long. It's a pleasure to be with you again and with your listeners, Hendrik.
Excellent. So, of course, there's a lot of things we could and we should dive into as well. We're going to talk a bit about some of the history here later. I want to get your take on what it is that's actually happening. But just do a quick little update here. Some of the latest headline I saw regarding this. Iran threatens 35 targets, including U.S. warships and Tel Aviv, after Soleimani's death. While Hezbollah issue ultimatum for Iraqis to leave U.S. bases by Sunday, and the White House says it expects an attack. So what do you think? I mean, do you think an attack is coming? Is this going to escalate, or is this going to die out? That's the main question we all want to know. What's your take?
Right. Well, right now, the funeral processions for Qasem Soleimani are reaching their conclusion in Iraq. His body and that of the head of the Hashdol Shabi militia were basically put into a procession between the cities of Karbala and Najaf, the two holiest Shiite cities in Iraq, which are also, of course, sacred cities for the vast majority Shiite population of Iran. And so that funeral procession is reaching its conclusion. Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, declared 3 days of mourning for Qasem Soleimani yesterday. So that mourning period should reach its conclusion either tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. I don't expect any retaliation to take place while these mourning and funeral processions are ongoing. I think that Iran will wait at least until that period has concluded. And I also think that the Iranian government will wait until the vote is held tomorrow in the Iraqi parliament over whether to expel U.S. forces from
That's
Iraq.
That's right. I heard that. Yeah, very interesting.
Yes, that vote was initially scheduled for today, and it was postponed until tomorrow in order to pay respect to Qasem Soleimani while his funeral was held. And the assessment by most analysts is that the factions of the Iraqi parliament loyal to Iran have by far a majority vote. They have certainly over 50%. They have a significant percentage to vote for the expulsion of U.S. forces from Iraq. And I think that the Iranians will wait until that vote is held before they take any action.
Now, I mean, isn't it a little ironic, though, that they have a vote on the fact if U.S. should leave or not? The government that exists there now would, of course, not be in place if U.S. hadn't invaded to begin with back in 2003. And, of course, they weren't invited by the Iraqis then. But still, it shows just how much things have transformed in the region. Like, although that U.S. have placed a lot of their puppets in place, now Iraq is like, essentially in a situation with, like, okay, we might expel you guys because we want nothing to do with you, right? So it's
The United States was only able to put its puppets in place for, I think, the first 18 months or so after the invasion. You know, what the planners of the Iraq War in 2003 ought to have considered is that the majority of the Iraqi opposition to Saddam Hussein was living in exile in Iran. And so the Iraqi government, by and large, is constituted of people who spent the 1980s and 1990s living in Iran and forging close relationships with the theocratic leaders of Iran, their fellow Shia believers. And so, you know, the ties between the Iraqi government and Tehran are extensive and reach far back, you know, decades back to the war with Saddam Hussein. For example, the Hashdol Shaabi, whose leader was assassinated together with Qasem Soleimani, the Hashdol Shaabi consisted of Iraqi fighters who defected to Iran to fight on the side of Iran in the Iran-Iraq war. So, you know, it's no surprise that this Iraqi government, when push comes to shove, is going to vote American forces out of Iraq and basically allow the Iranians to take over all of the security responsibilities that had been performed by the United States to date. So far as I can tell from mainstream media reports, the United States has already, in anticipation of this decision, stopped training Iraqi security forces.
Oh, really? Wow, that's very, very interesting. Now, of course, we should point out as well, and we covered that yesterday in our Flashback Friday show in our shorter segment of this. But again, for those that might have missed that, what's interesting, of course, is, let me see if I can pull it up here, is that Soleimani was, of course, one of the primary players. Here's the story. Iran's Qasem Soleimani is guiding Iraqi forces in fight against ISIS, right? So he was actually holding back and managed to push back against some of the most extreme elements in the region, which, of course, we know has been a proxy, an asset, essentially, of the coalition forces, U.S. and everyone else that's doing that. Now, that's, of course, they've continued to deny that. There's been a cover-up. They've said, hush, hush, that's not really happening. They're just funding the funding and supporting the moderate rebels, as they call it. But that simply has been an interface between, like, the coalition forces and ISIS, essentially. But what do you think it means for him being a central component to helping to fight ISIS that he's been taken out? Is that going to ISIS going to gain back ground now? Because they're almost at the brink of being gone from the region as far as they're in Idlib essentially, and that's it as far as I know.
Yes, well, you know, Newsweek ran an article on this that was quite controversial, partly because of its cover. Its full cover featured the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, and the header was, if Iran falls, ISIS may rise again. And I think the author of that article basically carried out a sound analysis that the collapse of the Islamic Republic of Iran, or the, you know, attempted overthrow of that government, would lead to a vacuum of power in Iraq and the rise of some new form of Sunni caliphate. It may not be the Islamic State with the same leaders and same organizational structure that it had, but it will be some form of Sunni fundamentalist caliphate.
Yeah.
And, you know, however ideologically opposed one may be to the Islamic Republic in Tehran, or, you know, to the worldview of Qasem Soleimani, by comparison to Sunni fundamentalism, believe me, it's far less threatening to the West or to any civilized country or culture.
Yeah, so let's see if we can dive into this a little bit. I know that there's some predictions that you wanted to talk about, you know, and that's important and interesting. But just historically, from a historic perspective, what do you think is worth to know about the situation overall? Because, of course, you've talked about this for a long time. You're half Iranian. You have a lot of people that you know there. You have contacts. You've been working, with a lot of different organizations and stuff like that, too. That are essentially, well, you could explain it better than me, but essentially you're very aware that the regime that's there now is something that you're not, you know, very much in favor of, obviously. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that you're favorable towards an invasion and an American takeover of the region either. Maybe there's a balance in between. But if we just go back to, you know, 50s and 60s, Iran was fairly secular, right? And I mean, it was later when the when the Shah was taken out, this was a CIA, you know, operation run by the intelligence services. They put their puppets in place like they have in so many Middle Eastern countries. But that was really the progression towards this radicalized Islamic faction in Iran. What do you think is worth just mentioning about that piece of history?
Well, you said a number of things there. You know, I think that whatever the dynamics were in 1979, you know, during the rise of the Islamic Republic, the overthrow of the Shah, and the institutionalization of the present regime, one fact from a historical standpoint that needs to be acknowledged is that for at least 500 years, Shiaism and Iranian national identity have been inextricable. So, you know, after the Arab Muslim invasion of Iran, the Arabian Caliphate dominated much of what had been ancient Iranian civilization. And here and there, you had Iranian fiefdoms assert a degree of autonomy make efforts to revive the Persian language, and ultimately, by around 1000, effect a Iranian cultural renaissance. But there was really no centralized Iranian national government again after the Islamic conquest until 1500, when a Iranian Kurd and mystic, Shah Ismail Safavi, took a certain sect of Shiaism and institutionalized it as the Iranian state religion. And what this did was it took a minority sect within Islam and fused it with the Iranian sense of cultural and ethnic identity in a way that isolated Iran from the ocean of the Sunni Islamic world. And this allowed Iran to redevelop cohesive national borders, which were then sustained in one form or another under one dynasty or another for the next 500 years. So, and, you know, the dynasty that he founded, the Safavid dynasty, was actually able to bring a fourth Persian empire to power. I mean, Iran not only regained its national identity, Iran established a vast empire stretching all the way from parts of what's today Western Pakistan and all of Afghanistan through Iraq and into parts of Eastern Turkey. So the Safavid Empire lasted several hundred years and was both a fourth Persian Empire and, in a sense, a theocratic Shiite state. So while, you know, there were various intelligence machinations involved in the revolution that toppled the Shah and brought the Islamic Republic to power in 1979, the popular support base for Ayatollah Khomeini and for the governing ideology of the Islamic Republic does reach back centuries into Iranian history. And the cultural and spiritual roots of the ideology of the Islamic Republic are also the cement that unites Iran and Iraq as effectively a single socio-political entity in the contemporary context.
Right. So you know, a lot of changes have happened in the region, and of course, it's no secret that Israel has been tremendously. As one of the biggest meddling forces in the region, it does things that benefits itself. It does so by using other countries as proxy, like America, but other forces as well, like the relationship with Saudi Arabia and stuff like that. But how do you see that this is serving the general kind of agenda moving forward? I mean, do you think that this will break out in a war if there isn't a retaliation to be expected?
Henrik, it is a war. It's not a question of whether it's going to break out as a war. I think every sound analyst agrees that this strike was an act of war. I'll tell you an interesting piece of information that I heard. It seems that within the last 24 hours, Trump sent an envoy to the Swiss embassy in Tehran, which is the site of the intersection of the United States in Iran. So, you know, the United States obviously has no embassy in Tehran, neither does the Islamic Republic have an embassy in the United States. But each country has an interest section inside the embassy of another foreign nation. Iran's is in the embassy of Pakistan in Washington, and America's is in the Swiss embassy in Tehran. Hmm. And apparently Trump, listening to statements, for example, from the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations, who said at the United Nations that there would be a severe retaliation and that it was within Iran's rights to retaliate to what was an act of war, Trump got the message and sent an envoy to the Swiss embassy telling the Iranians, get this, we expect a retaliation from you, but please retaliate commensurately.
What?
Trump probably means kill a general or two. Look at the cavalier attitude of this man who is willing to, first of all, throw a couple of American generals as red meat to the Iranians, mm-hmm. and then presumably not retaliate subsequently. In other words, he would de-escalate at that point. He would say, well, we got Soleimani and we sacrificed, you know, a general or two as pawns, and then this is the end of this engagement, right? Well, the Iranians came back and said, basically, go to hell. We'll decide at what scale we're going to retaliate and, you know, when and at whatever time of our choosing. That's one interesting story I heard. The other one is that the IRGC, basically think tank, the IRGC strategic analysis group that's responsible for planning military operations, came to Ayatollah Khamenei, to the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, and this was probably late yesterday. And they said to him, look, perhaps a commensurate retaliation will be to take out CENTCOM in Qatar. The United States Central Command for the entire region is in Qatar. And the proposal was made to Ayatollah Khamenei that the entire CENTCOM should be taken out with an Iranian ballistic missile strike. And the supreme leader replied that that wasn't anywhere near a sufficient retaliation.
Right.
So I think that gives you an indication. And then this article that you put up on the screen that now it's leaking 35 separate targets have been chosen for the Iranian retaliatory strike makes it clear that, you know, this is really a war. We're in a war. The first strike was by the United States. But, you know, I think that there's going to be a dramatic escalation after the Iranian retaliation.
Now, as always, it's very hard to know, you know, who, if we are getting the right information, who's telling the truth, what the misinformation is and all that kind of stuff. But, it, I mean, overall, I mean, isn't this just another, it's a way to instigate and say, here, you go ahead, Iran, do something dumb, do something stupid, you know, and we'll use that as the excuse to finally just do a full-on invasion, or at least, I mean, do you think it will ever get to that? There's been so many proxy wars, there's so much drones attacks now, there's so much, you know, this, what's the term for it, like distant warfare, whatever they call it, to get American troops on the actual ground in a bordering country like Iraq or something and, like, invade Iran. How likely do you think that actually is?
I think it's likely, and I will tell you exactly why I think it's likely. And, you know, one of the but there's a lot that I think we should lay out before we get to that
sure,
point.
Sure. We can back up if you want.
Let me just, you know, up front tell you what I think the problem is with the assumption in the back of your mind when you suggest that it's highly unlikely. Of course, you're thinking, as many people are, that Iran is a vast country. It's, you know, three or four times the size of Iraq. We're talking about a country that's three times the size of France, okay? And it consists of 70% mountainous terrain, all right? And the mountains are ringing the country toward its western and southern borders, which are the borders the United States would want to use to invade. In other words, a ground invasion from Iraq and a naval invasion across the Persian Gulf. Those would bring you up against two mountain ranges that fortify central Iran. So this is, in fact, an incredibly difficult country to invade. On the eastern frontier, you have two vast deserts, Dasht-e Kavir and Dasht-e Lut towards Afghanistan. So reaching central Iran would be a nightmare. I don't think the United States would ever have faced a comparable challenge in terms of invading a country, even when you look at the Second World War, because, you know, the French population, by and large, when Normandy took place, the French population was by and large on the side of the United States and saw them as liberators. I don't think you're going to encounter quite the same thing in Iran. So I see why you would suggest that, given the experiences the United States has had in Iraq and Afghanistan, that, you know, the commanders involved, decision makers, perhaps Trump himself, would consider it inadvisable to undertake such an invasion. But here's the mistaken assumption. The mistaken assumption is that the strategic goal would be to reach central Iran and occupy Tehran or even Esfahan or Shiraz, major Persian cities at the core of Iran. Mm-hmm. That would not be the goal of an invasion of Iran. The goal would be to come in after separatists, after ethnic minority groups have been armed and turned against the central government of Iran, once they have engaged in rioting and arson and inflamed various outer provinces like Khuzestan, or as the Arabs call it, the Al-Ahwaz province on the northern end of the Persian Gulf, or Kurdistan, Iranian Kurdistan, or the Iranian part of Azerbaijan, or Baluchistan on the Pakistani border. These are all peripheral provinces of Iran that are populated by the Sunni religious minority of Iran and by various ethnic minorities in Iran. And the goal of a ground invasion would be to bring U.S. troops and naval personnel into these peripheral provinces and hold them and wait for the central government of Iran to collapse. There would be no attempt to march on Tehran. So I think that kind of a peripheral ground invasion would be the end game of a Trump war with Iran. Of course, there would be lots of escalation that would take place before then.
Right.
So, but as an end game, yes, I think it's quite possible. You know, I've been seeing this nightmare on the horizon for years.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, they've talked about it for years. It's never really happened ever since the days of, well, obviously 9/11, then they went into Afghanistan, then on false premises they went into Iraq, which is, of course, why this mess today, or yesterday, or a few days ago actually happened, is because America shouldn't have been in Iraq to begin with.
Let me point something out about that. I mean, everybody's saying this, that, I mean, everybody who's at least relatively sane and not a total shill of the military-industrial complex is pointing out the fact that we shouldn't have been in Iraq in the first place. But I don't think they come close to even grasping how true that is. Iraq is a region of Iran. Iraq was the capital of Iran for more than 1,000 years. The first three Persian empires had Iraq as their capital district, not any territory within Iran. So, you know, Babylon was the capital of the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Seleucia was the capital of the Parthian Empire. And Tisfun or Ctesiphon was the capital of the Sassanid Empire. All of these cities are inside of Iraq. They're inside what's now the Shiite bastion of southern Iraq, south of Baghdad. So when we talk about Iraq, we're talking about, the District of Columbia, the capital district of Persian empires, three successive Persian empires for well over a millennium. Mm. Okay? Mm-hmm. Then the city of Baghdad itself is a Persian city. Baghdad in ancient Persian means given by God or God's justice. So the city of Baghdad itself, in its etymology and its origin, is a Persian city. Then when we look at northern Iraq, when we go to the north of Baghdad, the Kurds are an ethnic and linguistic group of Iranians. The Kurds are ethnically and linguistically Iranian. Whatever these Kurdish separatists who are funded and armed by Israel or Saudi Arabia would like to tell you, the reality is that the Kurds, you know, are Iranian as, the Danes are Germanic. You know,
right. So, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. They are like, there's a Germanic world that includes Scandinavia.
Sure.
Yeah. And, the Scandinavians are not German, but they are Germanic. And in that sense, the Kurds are part of the Iranian ethnic and linguistic world. And they've been part of all of the Persian empires. So even northern Iraq is part of the Iranian civilizational sphere. when you understand that and you look at the fact that the United States has crossed 11,000 kilometers to go to the other side of the world and send military forces into what was the heart, the sociopolitical heart of Iran for so long, you realize how absurd it is when people talk about Qasem Soleimani killing 600 American soldiers. What the hell were they doing there in the first place?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the justification, right, they bring. Oh, well, he murdered Americans. Okay, well, who had murdered... I mean, look at the confession of... who was that crazy lady again? It was like 500,000 children, Iraqi children. Was it worth it? Who was it that made that comment again? You know who I'm talking about, right? Yeah, he was sitting on 60 Minutes saying, yeah, we think it was worth it. Like, that's the death tally, right? And again, as you say, who went the furthest to go to someone's territory and region to invade them and to meddle in them? But again, this is all, I mean, it's not just one thing that all of a sudden happened. This goes back to when the British came to the region, starting carving that up and stuff. And it goes back, you know, before that. I know it's a succession of events, right? But the meddling, the interference, the toppling of leadership, the putting of puppets in place have just gone on for a couple of centuries almost now, right?
Yeah, as you said, the British basically drew the borders of all of these artificial states in the Middle East. Iraq is not a real country. Iraq is an artificial state created by the British in the wake of the First World War. And in fact, if you look at the map of the Islamic world, the core of the Islamic world, not just the Middle East, but also in Central Asia, the only real country in that entire region is Iran. The only country where if you look at maps, you know, from 300 years ago, 500 years ago, the country that's there and is still there today is Iran, which is a real cohesive nation with a 3,000-year-old civilizational history. The rest of these so-called nation states are bullshit artifacts of European colonialism. And I think where that's going to be really relevant is after this vote is held tomorrow in the Iraqi parliament. We're going to see whether the United States, who claim to be bringing democracy to Iraq, is going to respect the democratic decision of the Iraqi parliament to expel U.S. forces from Iraq. And my guess is that there's going to be a major struggle over the expulsion of U.S. forces from Iraq, and that there will be parts of the Iraqi government that are basically financially beholden to the United States military-industrial complex, which will break away from the Iran sympathizing Shiite majority, and you're going to see over time a collapse of the Iraqi government and a struggle between the United States and Iran within the borders of Iraq. So actually, the first ground war that will take place between American and Iranian forces, I predict, is going to be within the territory of Iraq itself. And one of the reasons I think that is that the leader of one of the deadliest Iraqi militias in the first few years after the American invasion and occupation, Muqtada al-Sadr, the leader of the Mahdi militia, went to Iran, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 months ago, and he swore allegiance to Ayatollah Khamenei. And in the pictures of the event where he swore allegiance to Ayatollah Khamenei, to the supreme leader of Iran, he is sitting next to Qasem Soleimani. Now, guy, Muqtada al-Sadr, he was co-opted for a while by the Americans. You know, the Americans basically convinced him to disband the Mahdi militia, and he was willing to negotiate with the Americans for some time. But I suppose they screwed him like they screw everybody else they get into business with. And he decided come under the wing of the supreme leader of Iran. So my guess is you will see groups like the Mahdi militia led by Muqtada al-Sadr collaborate closely with Iran, potentially with actual Iranian ground forces, in an attempt to forcibly remove American troops from Iraq. And this will take place as the Iraqi central government collapses, all of which validates the historical fact that Iraq is an artificial state. It doesn't have any real ethnic or linguistic cohesion. And I think its fate is going to be sealed in the course of this war.
All right. Well, I mean, that's fascinating. There's just a million tangents that we could go on here. Let's talk just a little bit about Israel's meddling in the region and Zionism as a force, you know, in the Middle East, and what we've seen ever since, well, both the founding, I guess, but even further back than that, that they have meddled so much. There's so many things that benefits them with having these tensions and stuff like that. Of course, a strong Iran with a strong funding, if a functioning economy, and all these kinds of things that we're heading towards getting. Supposedly, allegedly, nuclear weapons of their own and stuff like that. It's clear that Israel has been like, no, we're not going to allow the Iranians to get that far. We're gonna demonize them if we have to, you know, do false flag or trip them into situations where they react and act in a way that benefits them so that they can attack. Consequently, they'll do that, right? They'll play foul. They'll play dirty. Is this an attempt just to keep the destabilization of like Iran and the region overall going, so that there isn't this kind of where these countries become self-sufficient? They begin to trade with other countries, because as far as I know, too, I mean, Russia, they're on good terms with Iran. China, they've talked about partnerships with Iran as well.
Before I answer your question about Israel, let me just say on that specific point that this current inflaming of the situation, you know, with the surrounding of the U.S. embassy in Baghdad and then the strike on Soleimani and so forth, is coming after over a year of the American strangulation of the Iranian economy. Trump's crippling sanctions on Iran embargoed the sale of Iranian oil to Iran's closest allies. Iran has major trading partners like Russia, China, India, which purchase Iranian oil. Trump's sanctions made it impossible for these countries, I mean, Russia doesn't purchase Iranian oil, but India and China were major buyers of Iranian oil. And the Indians actually had to change their petroleum refining infrastructure to import Saudi oil rather than Iranian oil, because the United States prevented the sale of Iranian oil to the Indians and to everybody else. So, you know, the Iranian economy has been targeted for total destruction by the Trump administration in the wake of Trump's withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in May of 2018. The destruction of the Iranian economy is certainly a goal that Israel wanted to see, and one that the Trump administration has been all too happy to materialize for Israel.
Yeah,
but Israel's main concern has allegedly been with Iran's nuclear program, right?
Yeah.
Well, the Iranians, surprisingly, I would say, have shown tremendous patience in remaining within the JCPOA. They've remained committed to the JCPOA in terms of a willingness to negotiate with the European parties to the deal to try to find some way around Trump's sanctions and the American unilateral withdrawal. But do you really think that after this kind of a strike, the Iranians are going to remain party to the JCPOA? Absolutely not.
No, I guarantee
you, Iran will totally scrap the nuclear deal at this point, and not only will they restart uranium enrichment for the sake of nuclear power, I would be shocked if a decision as of this hour hasn't already been made in Tehran for the industrial production of nuclear weapons.
And it wasn't already?
No, I don't think so. Okay. There are a set of countries that have the capability to develop nuclear weapons but do not do so. I mean, Germany, Japan, Argentina, Brazil, these are all countries that have nuclear energy programs. They have the industrial infrastructure and the military know-how to manufacture nuclear weapons, but they've decided for political reasons not to do that. Iran, it's well known that Iran in the early 2000s, you know, during the Cheney administration, as I like to call it, did consider manufacturing nuclear weapons, and they came right up to the line of doing so. But a political decision was made not to do it because they considered it a tripwire. They knew that the Israelis would know when they did it and that it might invite an Israeli airstrike and so on and so forth. So they decided not to do it. So as of this time, Iran has not manufactured nuclear weapons off an assembly line. Whether or not they have a few prototypes of something or other is another question. But they have not industrially manufactured nuclear weapons. I guarantee you that after the strike Trump carried out 48 hours ago, the decision has been made in Tehran to go that route. And so when you ask about, Israeli aggression against Iran and Zionist plans for the future of Iran, I think that we ought to expect that Israel will ultimately carry out airstrikes inside Iran against targets that it believes to be nuclear weapons development facilities.
Now, I'm looking for the article, but I thought this was just a while back when Israel claimed they had done some strikes in Syria, but there was the Iranians that were helping the Syrians to develop nuclear weapons. And like, oh, we prevented it, we stopped it, or whatever. I can't find the exact article right now, but this has been going kind of back and forth for a long time. And, of course, needs to be mentioned every single time that Israel, of course, has nuclear weapons, but we wouldn't even know that if it wasn't for the whistleblower. What was his name again? Who spoke out about this, and he ended up in prison for Vanunu, you know, who bravely spoke out about that. But again, Israel, they don't have to go, you know, be part of the proliferation treaty and these kinds of things, right? That they can do whatever the hell they do. But when Iran wants to achieve the very same thing that they have, the whole world, it just goes up in flames. We gotta stop them. We gotta do all these things. I mean, just if you can you explain that a little bit, just the mentality of the leader? And I know that you have not been like super supportive of like the current, you know, establishment in Iran and stuff like that. But at the same time, it seems that the rest of the world is trying to make, these are psychopaths. They will just, if they get the nuke, they'll just bomb everybody and stuff like that. What's really going on with the leadership there?
Okay, so a couple of things. First, I'll answer your second question first and then go back to what you were saying about Iranian nuclear weapons potentially being developed in Syria, because there's a very big clue there to the scale of confrontation that we're facing now. But just in terms of your last point, look, Russian Orthodox Christians who are patriotic were vehemently opposed to the Soviet Union. Right?
Yeah.
They're opposed to the communist ideology.
Right.
That doesn't mean that after the United States developed nuclear weapons in the 1940s, that such Russian patriots wouldn't want their country to have nuclear weapons.
Right.
Right? And if you look at the Islamic world as a whole, and you think in terms of civilizational politics, which I think is how we ought to conceive of relations between peoples and cultures at this point in history, I accept Huntington's characterization of our epoch as the epoch of the clash of civilizations. And Huntington draws a distinction between core states and peripheral states in the clash of civilizations. And he notes that the only major civilization in the world that's lacking a core state, and a recognizable core state, is the Islamic civilization. So, you know, you got this Eastern Orthodox civilization with Russia as the core state. The United States of America is the core state of the West presently. China is the core state of a Chinese civilization that's almost entirely coextensive with the People's Republic of China, barring Taiwan and maybe Singapore and so forth. But in the Islamic world, it's hard to see what the core state is. If you look at the various contenders for core state of the Islamic world, whether it's Pakistan or Egypt or Turkey, Iraq, of course, is a failed state, so it's not a contender. There is no country that has the sophistication of culture, the historical depth, okay, and the capacity to act as a bridge between various other nations and civilizations more than Iran does. I mean, Iran is the key contender for civilizational core state of the Islamic world. And while Iran is majority Shia, there are many Iranians outside of the borders of Iran, in Afghanistan, in Tajikistan, the Kurds in northern Iraq, who are Sunni but are either ethnically or linguistically part of the Iranian world. So when you consider Iranian identity in addition to the Shiite spirituality that brings a great many Arabs under the umbrella of, you know, the Iranian world, I think that Iran is the most reasonable candidate for core state of the Islamic world for the sake of maintaining peace and stability across the entire planet. And if that is true, now that's a roundabout way to answering your question, but it's the only way to answer it with sufficient precision and, you know, detail. If you consider that argument, you have to come to the conclusion that Iran needs nuclear weapons, irrespective of the government that is in power. Iran, not Pakistan, should be the country maintaining order at the core of the Islamic world.
It is pretty interesting that Pakistan has it when you say it, you know, but Iran doesn't. It's very bizarre, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it's preposterous to think that somehow the ideology of the Islamic Republic is more at odds with the West or, you know, with American culture than that of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
I mean, you cannot find any more despicably inhuman and backwards regime than the regime of Saudi Arabia. And, you know, a lot of people make the case that, well, at least the Saudis aren't trying to export their form of government to other countries, whereas the Iranians are exporting the Iranian revolution. And, you know, Qasem Soleimani was allegedly the mastermind of exporting the Iranian revolution. You just need to go to European cities where Wahhabi and Salafist mosques are being founded on a weekly basis to see how the Saudis are exporting.
That's right. They are funding. That's come out. They've even openly suggested it. Hey, we'll fund, and they do fund mosques in the West, in Germany, in Sweden, all these places. They're quite open about that, about the takeover.
I don't see mosques in Europe with the portrait of, you know, Ayatollah Khamenei up there, or militant Shiaism being funded in Europe by the Iranian government or in the United States. The Sunnis based in Saudi Arabia, they're doing that, who have been chosen by the United States as the de facto guarantors of peace and security in the region, to the extent that Donald Trump, in his infinite wisdom, last year referred to the Persian Gulf as the Arabian Gulf in his policy speech on Iran. That's how much he is catering to these Wahhabis and Salafists that he did a sword dance with a few months after he assumed the presidency.
Yeah, I remember that. Holding the orb and all that weird stuff. It's kind of funny looking at that. Of course, I mean, Iran hasn't played ball in a lot of these things. They have, you know, it's one of the countries that don't have a central bank. They have had some very... Well, I mean, it goes against the what should we call it? What's the correct wording here? Against
the neoliberal world order.
The truths of our times, right? They've actually held conferences on revisionist topics and all these kinds of like off the wall kind of stuff that you're not you're not allowed to do that. There is a lot of antagonism between, as you said, the liberal world order, this new structure that's arising. Some people call it the new world order, and Iran has not been willing to like just be absorbed into that or be. Again, although there has been, yes, takeovers and coup in Iran in the past, it's not totally under their control and haven't been, right?
So this is a good segue to answering the first part of your compound question that you asked that had to do with this story that the Israelis were attacking sites in Syria, but there were actually Iranian nuclear sites in Syria.
Yes, yes.
So yes, Iran is outside this neoliberal world order, okay? But Iran is not just outside of this... neoliberal world order as an isolated nation, you know, like North Korea, for example. I mean, North Korea is also outside the, establishment. It also flouts the global establishment and doesn't adhere to international norms. But Iran is a completely different case from North Korea because it has managed effectively to build a fifth Persian empire across the Arab Shiite world. Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen. These proxies of Iran are effectively colonial territories. You know, it's wrong to call them colonial territories. What it really is, frankly, is a reconquista. You know, when the Spaniards lost Andalus to the Muslims, after, you know, a century and a half or so, they engaged in a reconquista of that territory. These territories have been part of the Iranian civilizational world. And what we've seen, largely under the direction of Qasem Soleimani, after the Americans opened up a power vacuum in the Middle East with the Iraq War, what we've seen is a reconquista of territories that were part of Iranian civilization. So, you know, it's not surprising that the Iranians might attempt to manufacture nuclear weapons not inside their own territory, but in a facility in Syria. And that, you know... the Iranian nuclear weapons program would be decentralized in a way that isn't commensurate to the national borders of Iran, but that reflects a kind of international civilizational alliance. And so when we think of Iran as outside of extant international norms and a country that's flying in the face of the neoliberal world order, it's also to understand that Iran is a pole in a potential new world order. Iran is one of many poles of a potential multipolar world. And this is what makes the Islamic Republic of Iran so dangerous. And it's also one reason why I've become increasingly skeptical of regime change in Iran. Because having been a part of the Iranian opposition at the highest level for years, I can attest to the fact that there is no cohesive, well-organized, visionary, responsible Iranian opposition that will be able to replace this regime and maintain Iran's independence and Iran's potential to bring forth a new multipolar world order with Iran as one of the poles of that new global system. So, you know, the Russians, famously, you know, Alexander Dugin, who's Putin's leading advisor, the Russians have spoken for years about a multipolar world where Russia would be one of the poles of a new world order. And I think Iran, together with China, is another non-Western country that could be at the center of a civilizational sphere of influence that is peaceably maintained and, you know, secured by a population with a very sophisticated and ancient culture, rather than the barbarians that we're currently allied with in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and I mean, what would you say to that, too? Because a lot of people, of course, they do get, you know, it's understandably, as you said, I mean, it's like they first of all, they bunch as Islam together as one, which you've already demonstrated there. They're not. There's much more going on than that. There's different factions, Shia, Sunni. There's an internal schism within Islam, just like it has been in most major religions. But still, you know, they see that and they see, well, it's just an Islamic kind of takeover. I know that the historical aspects that you've been interested in has been, of course, a pre-Islamic era of the Persian Empire as well. And you've kind of argued in the past that there's a component of that that's still kind of been intact or still kind of in place, if you will, inside of it. Now, that's maybe hard for people on the outside to see or even recognize. But as far as I understand, Jason, that's one of the reasons why you've been, at least in the past, regime critic, right, of like Ahmadinejad and like that this leadership is not, they're not the true carriers of that ancient civilization. How do you view that today?
Yeah, look, the entire Islamic mystical tradition is an occulted continuation of the pre-Islamic Iranian spirituality, not just Zoroastrianism, but also Mithraism, Manichaeism, various other Gnostic religions of pre-Islamic Iran have survived in the form of Islamic mysticism. Sufi poets like Attar, Rumi, Hafez, great literary figures of allegedly Islamic spirituality are thoroughly Iranian in their worldview, okay? And so when you think about the ideology that you would want broadcast from Mecca to the rest of the Islamic world, what you want to hear over the loudspeakers of the Grand Mosque in Mecca being broadcast to, I don't know, soon a couple of billion Muslims on the planet, it would be infinitely preferable for that to be the poetry of Rumi or Hafez than to be Wahhabi or Salafist sermons.
Right.
So yeah. If you think strategically, you know, it's much better for humanity at large and especially for Europeans and Westerners for power to shift in favor of Iran in the Islamic world, and ultimately for Iran to even govern Mecca and Medina. And the other you know, important thing to remember about quote-unquote Islamic history is that all of the leading scientists and technological innovators in Islamic history, all the contributors to the so-called Islamic Golden Age, were Persians. Well, not all, but 90% of them, okay, 90% of them were Persians. So again, Iran historically has been the cultural, scientific, innovative core of the Islamic world. And if my goal is the renaissance of Iranian civilization, right, as part of promoting the as part of promoting human flourishing in general on this planet and an enrichment of culture in general on this planet, if my goal is a renaissance of Iranian civilization, then I think that the best way to achieve that is to maintain and increase Iranian geopolitical power in the core of the Islamic world and then affect a cultural revolution, a social transition that transforms Islamic civilization back into Iranian civilization. If you look at Iranian society today, it is simply not the case that this country can be transformed from an Islamic country to some kind of neo-Zoroastrian state without shattering Iranian society and completely isolating Iran from neighboring countries. An attempt to lobotomize Iran and turn it into a Zoroastrian country in a matter of years, let's say even a decade, would result in a disastrous civil war within Iran and a total destruction of Iranian influence both in the Middle East and Central Asia. Instead of effectively dominating, you know, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and potentially in the future Afghanistan and Tajikistan and other parts of Central Asia, Iran will be embattled on all sides. It will become an anomaly within the Islamic world with a culture as alien to the Islamic world as the Japanese culture is to the Chinese sphere in East Asia. And so I don't think that, you know, any thoughtful Iranian patriot who really in the long term wants to see a renaissance of Iranian civilization ought to believe that some kind of forcible regime change in Iran now is the way to bring that about. You know, a Zoroastrian revival in Iran cannot come at the cost of Iran's potential disintegration, balkanization, and its isolation at the very least from surrounding countries.
Now, just to reflect on that a moment, it's amazing how, you know, how that history has flipped, that's wrong to say, but the idea of who the extreme party is in the region, as you said before, with like Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabi kind of Salafist, you know, extremism that they're pushing, that America has ended up in a situation, well, no, they are great partners, they're our allies, they deny what they're doing in Yemen right now, they just covered that up for, I don't know, how long has that been going, for a year, 2 years now or something? It's crazy. And it's like, well, no, the Iranians are the crazy ones. It's their factionalism, what they're doing. That's the nutty stuff. What we're working with the real, the balanced partners. When that's just a total flip, right? A complete flip. And they've managed to pull that off, you know, beautifully, considering how much propaganda there is out there and stuff like that. Again, I don't know the intricacies of what's going on inside of Iran and all that stuff, but obviously, what people have to understand, no matter what side you're on, is that what country in the world would just lay down and roll over to the power structure that's trying to crush them? They say, well, we can't defend ourselves. We can't have organizations that are funding resistance and opposition in these other countries. You know, they always try to, like Hezbollah and some of these other organizations, like from Syria to Lebanon and some of these other countries, as you kind of explained. They have been, if not centrally organized by, so it's a big portion of that by Iranians, at least with resources and funding or aid, you know, from them and stuff like that. But that's obviously understandable. They're trying to prevent the total takeover of the region. They're trying to remain balanced, just like China have their own self-interest, or like Russia have their own self-interest, right? What do you think is going to happen though in the future here? That there seems to be, as America is increasingly collapsing on the inside, falling apart, it's demographically, it's transforming and changing, it's becoming therefore more divided. There's multiple different ethnic groups in America. They're jockeying for power internally. That's falling apart. I don't think you can go on forever with a military like that. Imagine, Jason, if they had some kind of draft or something right today. And I think there was a tweet about this too, by the way. Let's see if I can find that. I think it was Adam Green. Yeah, they're talking about a military draft now. I hope they try this. Maybe this will wake up America's to fight the Zionist control of our country. So it's a selective services, kind of some rumors about them. Say, well, as long as we can have president pass legislation in Congress that would also that would authorize a draft. Imagine, well, maybe not today, but imagine America 10 years from now, or even 20 years from now, all these different ethnic groups. America has been completely divided with Trump and stuff like that. The empire that America's used to represent, whether you like that or not, is obviously coming to an end. And there is a new kind of faction that's rising out of this as well. And I think China, I think Iran, I think Russia, they're playing a huge part in this new side, if you will, that's popping up. Now I know some people, just a caveat to that too, I know some people kind of, they say, well, that's the plan, that's what it's supposed to be, the destruction of America is intentional and stuff like that. But what do you make of that? I know you had some of your predictions. You were talking about this too, how these decisions that are being made today and how this plays out in the future is going to be seminal for, well, the survival of America overall. What do you think?
Yeah, at the end of the article that I just put out through Arctos, the Arctos Journal, I speculate that it's possible this war could become America's Afghanistan. In other words, you know, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in the late 1970s was a harbinger of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And in the same way, if this becomes a full-blown war, which I think it probably will.
It very well might, absolutely.
It could be, believe it or not, it could be, for the reasons that you just suggested, a harbinger of the collapse of the United States. Not only the end of the United States empire abroad, but the social problems. And let me just leave it at that. Let me leave the characterization at that. The social problems in this country are so severe, and this country is so divided against itself, I think more than at any other time in history since the Civil War.
I agree, yeah.
That if we were to see massive demonstrations against this war and against the government conducting this war and against the government potentially reinstituting the draft, it could precipitate the disintegration of the United States, which would, of course, begin with, for example, the state of California taking serious measures to secede from the Union.
Yeah.
And it would be a domino effect from there. So, I mean, that's considerably down the line. But if, let's say, the 2024 election were to go the wrong way, we might really head into that future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's up in the air at this point. And again, it's going to be an impossibility for the United States to maintain united as it becomes more multi-ethnic and multi-religious. And that's just a fact. What is the binding component? But let's just reflect on this, too. In the beginning of your article, you're talking about this, that you're comparing this event to very similar, comparable to the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, which, of course, was the linchpin for World War One and all the, well, the madness that went all the way up to 1945 after the aftermath of that. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, it's the question of entangling alliances. It's because, you know, Iran, again, is not an isolated nation state whose top general or second most significant political figure has been taken out. Iran is at the core of a kind of civilizational structure, a kind of, you know, Islamic NATO that includes Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and all of these other countries are going to be activated in response to this attack, particularly because it's Qasem Soleimani who built Iran's new empire abroad. It's Qasem Soleimani who had these close working relationships with Iraqi militias and Syrian political figures and who worked very closely with the Lebanese Hezbollah. So, you know, I think that the Trump administration couldn't have chosen a worse figure to target if they wanted to isolate this conflict to Iran. They chose the one man whose murder will be avenged by all kinds of other countries besides Iran. I mean, they chose the one man, the one Iranian to target, who is most popular across the Arab world. And you're going to have probably more Iraqis and Syrians and Lebanese willing to die to avenge Qasem Soleimani's death than Iranians themselves. And in that sense, I think you have a kind of a set of alliances comparable to the ones you had activated during the first, in the lead up to the First World War by the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. And what I also mean to suggest by this comparison is that at the time it occurred, no one would have believed that, you know, this assassination would lead to a world war. But, you know, in a way that may be just as shocking, I think there's a significant potential for this strike to lead not just to a war against Iran or a regional war, but ultimately to a war that redefines the world order. Because if you consider that the Iranian retaliation is going to be as vast and vehement as the Iranians are promising it will be, well then, you know, what kind of retaliation will Trump carry out in response to that?
That's just it. And we'll escalate.
If that response by Trump, if Trump's counterattack to the Iranian retaliation involves targeting Iranian cities, involves airstrikes within Iranian territory, do you seriously believe that Iran is not going to attack within the borders of the United States? It will. And if Iran attacks Washington or New York City, under the NATO protocol, all of the European countries party to NATO are going to be forced to go to war against Iran.
Yeah.
And we know that Donald Trump has already been, grabbing the NATO allies by the collar and telling these various prime ministers and presidents of NATO countries that if they don't pull their weight in the alliance, the United States is going to expel them from NATO.
Yeah.
So, and I think, though, that many of them will object. I think that, the Europeans are going to be far more critical of this intervention than they were even of the Iraq war.
Yeah, I
think
so.
Be that as it may, under the protocols of NATO, there will be a number of European countries that will be dragged kicking and screaming to fight Trump's war in Iran. And at that point, when you've got Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, in that combat theater, and then in the Middle East, and then you have a bunch of European countries that are fighting there, and you have the Russians and the Chinese supplying arms to the Iranians, state-of-the-art Russian and Chinese arms to the Iranians, the way the Chinese were supplying the North Vietnamese during the Vietnamese War, I think that describes a global combat theater. I mean, that is a world war.
This is not an easy task. It's for America. If they embark onto this... It's a totally different deal.
It's done.
I know. No, I got to present. But, if we see the visual, confirmation that, it's moving ahead, right? When we get that cue. As you were saying, it's rather when, not if. It's like it's just a matter of time because this escalation is happening. And at the same time, they want this escalation. I mean, if you look at the bigger picture, war is very beneficial to the world order. It reshuffles things. You can gain control. You can take out undesirable factions or even people. You can destroy entire countries. There's so much. This is just not, an accident,
The neocon goal, the goal that John Bolton was so single-mindedly pursuing when he was part of the administration, and the goal that I think, frankly, Mike Pence and Pompeo are still pursuing, despite what they claim. Pompeo claims he doesn't even want regime change in Iran. That's what he publicly says. But I think that the goal that the neocons are pursuing is the Balkanization of Iran. And they've wanted this for a very long time. It fits within their vision of the furtherance of the neoliberal world order. This is ironic, the way they call them neocons, neoconservatives, but really they're defending the neoliberal world order. Of course, as you know, what it goes back to is Leo Strauss,
Trotskyites,
classical liberal, whatever. But he's the fountainhead of neoconservative thought.
Yep.
At any rate, their vision is to break up any major world power into a series of micro states that can be more easily integrated into their global financial and control system.
That's right.
And Iran is a major obstacle for them. So the Balkanization of Iran has been a long-term goal that they've pursued. And definitely they'll want to see this dramatic escalation into a full-scale war, with the end game being, as I said earlier on in our conversation, the ground invasion of peripheral provinces of Iran containing religiously Sunni ethnic minorities.
Well, and look,
I want to try to carve a rump state of Persia from out of the heart of Iran.
Right. And again, look at the strategy of how they've dealt with the satellite states of Russia, for example, right? Yeah, color revolutions, yeah, take over here, take over there, subverting here and there. They put their boys in place in Ukraine, they fund them, they... And again, they, as we saw in Ukraine, they work with any faction. All of a sudden, it doesn't matter. You can have Zionists work openly with so-called national socialists and stuff. Like, that's irrelevant. They use whatever faction they can. And as you say, if there's an ethnic component, they will definitely play on that. I mean, and say, yeah, we can, if we can target some of these groups in especially the northern region, we can get them under our umbrella. That's kind of been the tactic, of course, in Syria as well. You cause that internal division in the country. Assad maybe was able to keep it together, but when you push enough rebel forces in there, and eventually, of course, the rise of ISIS itself, and you fund these groups, I don't know how many different radical groups you had in Syria at one point, like 20, 30 different ones, you know, and they don't even know who the hell is, what side they're on or anything like that. But that's what they would do. Internal division. They want to have it broken up. They want to have control. They want to take it over. They want to dominate. And right now they don't. And I'm very glad you just brought up that, because we got to always keep in our, you know, our eye on the ball, so to speak. What's the goal? Why are they doing this? What's the objective, right? That's the big questions. We can never lose sight of that. And it's, you know, we might get down into the weeds of the details and, you know, who's murdered, what and there and stuff like that. But again, we're talking about like psychopathic maniacs that are willing to do anything. They don't care about human lives. They don't care about freedom. They don't care about poor or weak groups. Any wording they use, like when you listen to Pompeo when he's talking, right, he's actually saying, we believe that the people of Iran will welcome this. This is for freedom. I mean, these double speakers, you know.
Let me say something about that. You know, we brought up Bashar Assad in Syria and then Pompeo and the people of Iran will welcome us and so forth. The big question here, if they pursue this to their end game, is whether they will get their Balkanization of Iran or whether it will result in a Syrianization of Iran. These are two related but different scenarios. You know, we did not see a Balkanization of Syria. There were no parts of Syria that became new independent states governed by, functional regimes. We didn't see, at least as of yet, we have not seen, for example, Syrian Kurdistan break off and become a country. Okay, it hasn't happened. So I think that what is much more likely to happen, if this situation escalates catastrophically, is not the Balkanization of Iran that the neocons would like to see, but a Syrianization of Iran, where, like Bashar Assad, the Islamic Republic of Iran remains in power in Tehran and continues to fight to maintain and regain territory. And the question will be how long America has the stomach to sustain that fight and whether it will continue past the 2024 election.
Yeah.
I think it's quite possible that, you know, a candidate like Tulsi Gabbard, whose predictions, whose warnings will be legitimated in the 2024 election, would be elected president and would withdraw all U.S. forces. At that point, the Syrianization of Iran could be reversed. And like Assad, the Islamic Republic could regain lost territory and restore the territorial integrity of Iran. And the attempt to Balkanize Iran will have failed. The idea that the Iranian people will rise up and act as a fifth column for invading American forces, or even in the aftermath of an American air campaign on Iran. The idea that there is a, you know, popular uprising brewing on a scale that would be capable of toppling the Islamic Republic is delusional. Someone who has been in the Iranian opposition at the highest level for years, let me tell you, it is not going to happen. If you look at the latest rounds of protests in Iran, the ones that took place in November, from mid to late November, in response to a hike in the price of gasoline, a reduction of subsidies on gasoline to try to save the Iranian economy in the face of these crippling sanctions that Trump has imposed. If you look at those protests, maximum, they involve 200,000 people. Now, that may sound like a lot, but 200,000 people against the backdrop of an 80 million population is nothing. 1,500 people were killed by the regime in those protests.
Mm-hmm. Right.
until hundreds of thousands of people are willing to be killed by this regime, they will not relinquish power. Okay? Until millions and millions of people are demonstrating in the streets of Iran's major cities, this regime will not relinquish power. The revolution in 1979 that brought Ayatollah Khomeini to power involved, at its height, 4 million demonstrators in the street, and that was against the background of a 34 million population. Today, Iran has a population of 80 million. A couple of hundred thousand protesters are not going to bring down this regime, especially not after the country is in a state of war against a foreign enemy.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we're much more likely to see the Syrianization of Iran rather than the Balkanization of Iran, and that's where we'll be at by the time the, not this election, 2020, but by the time the 2024 election rolls around. I think Trump will be reelected in 2020.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, the Democrats don't really have anybody to line up. And it's basically just he'll run off a steam of 2016, essentially, I think. And sure, there's a very there's a MAGA crowd that's very devoted, obviously. Trump can never do anything wrong. What was that? Repeat that last part.
He will be a war president. I mean, this is a very well-established trend.
Right.
That when we're in a major war, the American people don't like to change the president. Unless that war is going catastrophically badly, which by 2023 it will be.
And he said it. We could play that. That's funny. But he talked about it himself. Let's just listen to that. It's kind of funny because he was talking about Obama at that time. But he's doing all – I mean, this is just – he's in the pockets of these people. You know, it might have been genuine at some point early 2015 or something. But by the time he was put in the White House, he was just totally compromised and taken over, if he wasn't just a big phony fraud to begin with. But listen to this here.
Our president will start a war with Iran because he has absolutely no ability to negotiate.
Let me take that again in case you guys didn't hear that. Here we go.
Our president will start a war with Iran because he has absolutely no ability to negotiate. He's weak and he's ineffective. We have a real problem in the White House. So I believe that he will attack Iran sometime prior to the election because he thinks that's the only way he can get elected. Isn't it pathetic?
It's funny.
It's projection. This is classic Freudian projection or Jungian projection.
It's amazing.
It's exactly what he would do. It's why it was in his mind.
What he's doing. Now. Yeah, it's absolutely what he's doing now. Absolutely. And you know, just briefly again, I want to play that clip of Pompeo. He's an expert in, I mean, he did the same, and of course, in Venezuela, some of these other countries, they just like assign a person, like, well, we have declared an interim president, you know, and they're just trying to manifest that we have the support of the people, we stand with you and stuff. And as you say, it's like very small, some of these factions that they're dealing with, but they're desperately trying to, like, you know, like manifested, you know, creating it out of thin air, essentially. Listen to this clip here about Pompeo.
Make no mistake about it. The Trump administration is focused on protecting Americans to the maximum extent feasible. We made the conclusion that a statement that we issued was appropriate, that the timing was right for that. We have, as you've seen over the past weeks, we've taken actions by building out coalitions in the region, by working to make sure we strengthen our partners in Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis, all things aimed at deterring Iran from aggression. We will continue that action, and we'll continue to prepare to respond if that's what's required to keep Americans safe. I saw last night there was dancing in the streets in parts of Iraq. We have every expectation that people not only in Iraq but in Iran will view the American action last night as giving them freedom.
That's right.
Freedom to have the opportunity for success and prosperity for their nations. And while the political leadership may not want that, the people in these nations will demand it.
I mean, he's a pretty slick tongue, that guy. They think they're going to pull this off, which not this way. They're not going to be able to pull it off that way, you know. Maybe with bombs, you know, but not with like saying, well, we think they want it. They want freedom. But anyway, let's go. I want to make sure we talk about some more of these predictions that you're having. You dished out about 20 of them, and some we've covered already. I want to make sure that we get to some of what you think will happen as a consequence of this decision, the path that we've now entered onto. Which ones do you want to tackle of those, Jason?
Well, you know what? We'll run through them quickly, and I'll focus more on the ones that we haven't discussed so far.
Yeah. Do you have them there? So, do you want me to read them?
Yeah, no, I just lost your screen for a second. I got it back.
Okay.
The first few are no shockers. It's not really going out on a limb to say that there's going to be a severe Iranian retaliation. But if you were to have listened to the comments, 24 hours ago, there were a lot of people saying that this would just blow over. And I would say that not only is there going to be an Iranian retaliation, it's going to be a vast and vehement retaliation. And, after this vote is held tomorrow in the Iraqi parliament, I think there's going to be a serious struggle over the departure of U.S. forces from Iraq. I mean, a lot of American blood and treasure was sacrificed in Iraq, and I don't think the Americans are going to leave peacefully, especially if it means handing effective control of Iraq over to the Iranians. So those are the first two. Then I would say that, in retaliation to whatever response Iran has to the assassination of Soleimani, Trump will order airstrikes not only on Iranian targets in Iraq, but on targets within Iran itself, including the capital of Tehran. And the fourth prediction is that, as one would expect, the Iranians will respond to that by hitting targets within the United States. We could see a very rapid escalation that leads us to a point where we have Hezbollah terrorist attacks in places like Washington and New York City. There has not been a single Shiite terrorist attack in the United States. We have never seen a Shiite Muslim in all these 40 years that they claim that the Islamic Republic of Iran is some, insane, psychopathic, whatever, government run by madmen. There hasn't been a single Shiite Muslim terrorist attack in the United States. Well, you know what? Now there's going to be.
Right. And do you think that will be by people who are already in the country, like migrants that have come to America?
Yeah. It's well known that and this is my biggest problem with the border security, with the Mexican border security, is not as much necessarily the Mexicans, but the issue is that when you have a border that's open and you've got drug runners crossing it routinely, they're also taking money from terrorists and paramilitaries and so forth to facilitate their crossing into the country. We know that there are thousands of Iranian operatives, whether they're actually Iranian or whether they're Arab Shia, who are already inside the United States and prepared to strike targets in this country in the event of an existential threat to Iran, which they see as the protector of the Shiite Muslim world. Now, so I think we will see these attacks inside the United States, including Washington and New York.
Now, let me before you continue with number five there, this is what I think is so odd as well with like this the neoliberal world order. Now, ultimately, yes, I know that it's not about America. America is a tool that's currently being used. It's not going to be led by America in the future. America will be just like every other, just some region that's broken up under the global control, kind of rulership. I get that. But it's so bizarre that there's so many people that are like, they're okay with like open borders, mass, even legal mass migration in that sense, because it's causing these internal divisions, just like we saw with Chinese people who are literally working within intelligence services in the U.S. They get positions within the CIA and stuff like that. And they're literally on the payroll from the Communist Chinese Party, and they report back to them. There's been, I don't know how many, three, four, just in the last couple of years now that have been found out, if you will. Like, we don't have to dive deep into the weeds on this, but I just want to mention, like, how can you have that mentality of like, yes, we're, open borders, migration is great, let's bring everyone in, and then at the same time try to, like, advance a national security agenda, for example, right? Of trying to,
it
doesn't work. It's impossible, right?
Yeah, it's preposterous. It's a farce.
It is a farce, and it's meant to be. Anyway, we can move on now, Jason.
As I suggested earlier, I think that American and Iranian ground forces will clash inside Iraq before they clash in Iran. Long before there's an American attempted military invasion of Iranian territory, you're going to see not proxy combat, but direct combat between American military forces and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps inside Iraqi territory.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fifth prediction I have there. Sixth, you will also see in the Persian Gulf a naval confrontation between the United States and Iran. There was a brief naval confrontation between American and Iranian forces in 1987. Toward the end of the Iran-Iraq War, there was a naval skirmish between the United States and Iran in the Persian Gulf, which did not end favorably for Iran. But the Iranian Navy of 1987 is not the Iranian Navy of today. And I think that Iran has the capacity to inflict just devastating damage on the U.S. Navy in the Persian Gulf. And it remains to be seen how much of a stomach the American people have for that and for how long.
And it's already a reminder back what happened in, May, June, July, something like that. It was by proxy. It was oil tankers that were seized and, captured back and forth. But, again, that's the beginning. That's the ruminations of war right there,
That's right. That's right. And, it should be borne in mind that Bahrain, on the other side of the Persian Gulf, was the 14th state of Iran until 1971. The Shah was forced to relinquish Iranian sovereignty over Bahrain, and Bahrain is a majority Shiite country. And there's a bridge, there's a causeway between Bahrain and the oil fields of Saudi Arabia. And guess what the only part of Saudi Arabia is where any Shia live? The Shia are a minuscule, like 5% minority or something in Saudi Arabia. But it just so happens that all of the people living on the oil fields on the southern coast of the Persian Gulf in Saudi Arabia are Shia.
Interesting.
And there's a bridge connecting that part of Bahrain.
Right there. I got it on the map there.
Saudi Arabia to Bahrain. So it's not impossible to imagine that, at an advanced stage of this conflict, there would be an Iranian naval invasion of Bahrain and a crossing over into the Saudi oil fields by the Iranian Navy.
Interesting. All right.
Cool. So, I think that the most deadly threat faced by American forces in the region isn't going to be, though, from the Iranian Navy or Iranian ground forces. It's the ballistic missiles. And this is why Pompeo and these neocons have been so insistent on making ballistic missile reduction and the Iranian abandonment of the production of ballistic missiles as part of their agenda in any new negotiations with Iran. Trump claimed the main reason he scrapped the nuclear deal was because it didn't address Iran's ballistic missile production. Iran has hundreds of ballistic missiles all the way from medium to long range, and I think that the United States should expect that Iran will target the tens of American military bases, both in the Middle East and Central Asia, with ballistic missiles.
Yeah. And just
thousands of U.S. troops stationed in those bases, and they will be subject to Iranian ballistic missile strikes.
Yeah. I don't know what they would use if they would try to do strikes again on, on U.S. soil and stuff like that, but this would definitely start on American army bases and stuff like that. And again, I just want to show this quickly. Remember, Russia recently deployed the first hypersonic missiles. Apparently, there's no known defense against these. They travel at incredible speed, 27 times the speed of sound, carrying a 2-megaton nuclear weapon. America doesn't know how to take them down. They can't. They fly in these weird kind of up and down patterns and stuff like that. And again, it would all depend on what the relationship between Russia and Iran or China. And Iran, but I just want to sneak that in there before we continue.
I think if the war gets bad enough, and this was another one of my predictions, if the war gets bad enough and goes on for long enough that the Russians and the Chinese feel that their regional strategic interests are being seriously threatened, they will begin to supply Iran with some of these very advanced armaments. And, one thing Iranians are really good at is reverse engineering things. Iran is not one of these, third world countries that simply purchases hardware without actually attempting to manufacture it themselves. We saw that when the Iranians captured American and Israeli drones, they were able to reverse engineer these state-of-the-art drones and start rolling them off the assembly line themselves. So, this is a very significant increase in Iranian military capability that's on the horizon if the Russians feel sufficiently threatened by this American adventurism to start providing the Iranians with these kinds of sophisticated armaments.
Yeah, and again, we've already seen that in Syria, so there's nothing to stop them really from doing this with Iran as well. So we'll see. And America isn't at, they're not the tip of the spear of weapons development anymore. Russia is like way up there right now. So, you know. Yep.
Yeah, and I think that, all of this increases the likelihood if you have, advanced weapons manufacturing taking place inside Iran, whether it's ballistic missiles or whether it's the nuclear warheads ultimately to put on them, it increases the likelihood of an Israeli strike on Iranian territory, which is another one of my predictions, that, the unexpected patience and goodwill of the Iranians to remain within the JCPOA after the unilateral American withdrawal will now come to an end, and Iran will completely scrap this nuclear deal and begin not only to enrich uranium at high levels for energy, but as I suggested earlier, it will embark on a full-scale nuclear weapons program, and that will result in an Israeli strike on Iranian territory, which also means, to come to my ninth or tenth prediction at this point, that we will see Iranian and Israeli ground forces clash because the Lebanese Hezbollah is completely allied with the regime in Tehran. It's a proxy of the regime in Tehran. It's funded and armed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. And so, you will see another major confrontation between Hezbollah and Israel of the kind that we saw back in 2006 when Hezbollah basically mopped the floor with the Israeli military in southern Lebanon and northern Israel. But I think that in this case, you're actually going to see Iranian Revolutionary Guard units flown into Lebanon and embedded with Lebanese Hezbollah and potentially crossing into the northern border of Israel from southern Lebanon. So there will be a military clash between Iranian and Israeli forces, ground forces, on the northern border of Israel.
All right. Interesting. All right. Let's see here. What else did we have? You're talking about the... we kind of talked about that a little bit earlier, too. NATO joining in response to attacks on America.
But that really brings this to the level of a world war, is that however much these Europeans, resent the fact that they are treaty beholden to defend American adventurism, I mean, that is the nature of the NATO partnership. And so if there are Iranian attacks within the territory of the United States, I mean, potentially Trump could claim the provisions of NATO, Article 5, even if there's an attack on CENTCOM within
the
personal
law. Yeah.
But at the very least, once it comes to Iranian attacks inside American territory, the NATO treaty will be activated and there will be certain European countries, certainly the United Kingdom, that will enter the combat theater. And that makes this a global war in scope. And on the other side, which is another one of my predictions, is a no-brainer, you will see Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen fighting on the side of Iran. So this is a vast international conflict that has just been sparked by the assassination of Soleimani. It is not just an Iran war. It's a war with a country that has a whole civilizational sphere bound to defend it. And it's a country that's going to involve various European nations on account of their entangling alliance with the United States.
All right. Interesting. Okay, where were we? I think we're on 12 or 12, I think.
I suggested earlier that it's delusional to expect the Iranian people to rise up and topple this government. I do not think that the Islamic Republic will be overthrown by protesters. I think that whether Khamenei is killed by some kind of a drone strike or a U.S. Air Force operation, or whether insurgents within Iran assassinate the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic will survive the death of Khamenei. Okay, I mean, he could also die of natural causes. The man is very old, and a lot of people are surprised that he's hung on for this long. But detailed plans have been made for the succession to Khamenei. The Islamic Republic is not a it is not a monolithic and hierarchical state in the same way as Saddam Hussein's Iraq or Kim Jong-un's North Korea. This is a regime that has multiple potential centers of gravity. It can adjust its center of gravity in order to survive. It has a kind of Byzantine overlapping, interlocking power structure with many different ruling bodies that collaborate with each other in order to maintain order. And that gives it a degree of multi-stability and dynamism that will allow it to survive in a way that Saddam's Iraq did not when it was subjected to military assault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you touched on 13 already a little bit, that the Islamic Republic will not be overthrown by protesters. It's just not large enough at this.
On the other hand, I think the American government might be overthrown by protesters.
That's it.
If this war gets bad enough, and, you know, if it gets to the point where, I mean, tens of thousands of American soldiers have been killed and there's talk about reinstating the draft, I think it's possible that the anti-war demonstrations, which will already be massive in cities like New York and Los Angeles and so forth, these anti-war demonstrations may turn into anti-government demonstrations. And we may see a situation comparable to 1968, 1969 in the run-up to the 2024 election.
Yeah, I mean, do you think a lot of these liberals are going to line up and fight a war? And I mean, they'll fight it, right? And again, if it's resorts to some kind of draft or something, that's taking this into a completely different level, you know. And that's crossing a bridge I'm not sure they're comfortable doing, to be honest, because that, as you say, that could be so destabilizing to the U.S. that it could be too much to bear.
This is the one issue that could bring the far left and the far right together in the streets of American cities.
Yeah. In the past, ironically, we've seen the right wing kind of opposing, in, not the like neocon, obviously conservative, but I'm saying the alt-right or the far right, whatever you want to call it, the nationalists. They have, of course, been very opposed to the wars. Yes, you have the Tulsi Gabbards and stuff like that, obviously, but you can see the mainstream progressive liberal field, from CNN to MSNBC and these talking heads, to generally be for what the neocons want. They're all on the same page, actually, on that front.
Yeah, you mentioned Tulsi Gabbard. My prediction is that Tulsi Gabbard's repeated, I would say, prophetic warnings of war with Iran and potential nuclear war. I mean, this is her main campaign issue, is to end regime change wars and to avert the possibility of a nuclear war, of some kind of a world war involving a confrontation with Russia, for example. Mm-hmm. Right? I think that her warnings will be seen in hindsight as prophetic, and her position, which today is considered fringe and marginalized by the Democratic establishment, will be legitimated by the course of events that we witness.
Exactly. And I mean, she's fairly popular. They've been trying to keep her out, and it's kind of like a... I said Rand Paul, but it's almost like, you know, both Rand Paul, of course, is a little bit different, but Ron Paul, you know, they ran on this anti-war ticket, anti-interventionism and all that kind of stuff. And it's been fairly popular. And I think as this insanity continues, it will just continue to grow. And as you say, if something goes bad enough here, then Tulsi could very well be a candidate. Now, I don't agree with her on some other issues. I think she's kind of nutty on some stuff. She seems largely anti-white as the rest of them, which is, of course, kookery and crazy stuff. But, you know, that's a lot of the progressives and liberals. They love that these days. So maybe she can ride on that wave, too. I'm not sure.
Well, I think we're going to be in a national crisis by the time that election takes place in 2024. And I see her having been legitimated by then, and that she will be the Democratic candidate running against someone who is a Trump successor. In other words, with this war in progress and with this war, reaching its zenith in 2023 or so, I don't think the Republicans are going to run somebody who repudiates this war. They will run someone who's campaigning basically to prosecute this war to victory. Someone who's totally unapologetic, who wants to stay the course and basically bomb the hell out of Iran to victory. And that figure is either Mike Pence or less likely Mike Pompeo. I think probably one of these two figures, in all likelihood Mike Pence himself, who's, of course, a Christian fundamentalist fanatic and someone who's been calling for regime change in Iran for years. I think Mike Pence is a likely candidate to face off against Tulsi Gabbard in 2024. And the outcome of that election will decide the outcome of this war. It will decide whether, if Tulsi Gabbard becomes president, there's a sane, sudden American pullback. She orders a withdrawal of all forces, and it just basically America swallows its losses, cuts its losses, and admits defeat, but maintains its country and maintains its global influence to some extent, albeit conceding defeat in this war. Or whether we have some lunatic like Pence decide to potentially drop nuclear weapons on Iran in order to end this war. And I think that's a scenario where both Iran and America will lose. It's a scenario where we really at that point could see the territorial disintegration of Iran. We could see Iran's loss of territorial integrity. But we will also see a increasingly rapid social disintegration within the United States and, you know, certain states like California seriously considering secession from the Union. So that's a scenario where, you know, both Iran and America lose. And I think it's the nightmare that all of us should want to avert.
Now, you kind of covered some of these. We had five more to go there. Some of them you kind of covered in what you just said there. However, let me say, you're saying 19, a large part of the Iranian opposition will commit treason. Tell me about that. Did we talk about that? I don't think we talked about that.
I've worked with these people very closely for a long time now. And I have to tell you, I've never been more demoralized. I've never had more cause to be cynical in my life than as a result of what I've seen. Working with Iranians who are willing to side with foreign countries in military aggression against their homeland, who are willing to be funded by foreign governments to act as agents for regime change. But aside from their, aside from their beholdenness to foreign interests, they're also totally lacking in any organization and long-term planning and in the technocratic expertise to be able to restore order in Iran after a catastrophe like the collapse of the Islamic Republic. But what I meant specifically, you know, when I listed that as one of the predictions is that even though I heard repeatedly from some of these individuals that they were not seeking war and that, that no war would ever take place and that if it did, you know, they would not endorse it. It's clear to me at this point that once there are aerial campaigns targeting Iranian cities and even once American ground forces cross into Iranian territory, a lot of these so-called opposition figures will side with Trump over their compatriots mm-hmm. within Iran.
Right.
And I, you know, I'm an Iranian American. I'm born and raised in this country, you know, and, you know, so it's not an issue for me in the same way as it is an issue for them. Their country is Iran. They are immigrants and refugees in America or Europe or wherever they may be. Their homeland and their fatherland is Iran. And so for them to do that is to commit an act of treason. Now, what sane person would want a bunch of traitors to constitute the government that's a successor to the Islamic Republic?
Right, right.
If this is the character that they're showing now or that they're going to show in the course of this war, you know, why would we want these people to constitute the regime that's a successor to the Islamic Republic?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, you know, unfortunately, another one of the predictions I have is that you will have that, you know, the most hardcore forever Trumpers, the people who will get off the Trump train last, or really they will ride it all the way until the train is derailed and, shattered in some canyon, are going to be members of the Iranian opposition. They will be Trump's longest and most hardcore supporters.
Very interesting. Yeah, strange. And I know you didn't kind of expect that turn of events, right?
I did not. But let me tell you, Hendrik, frankly, I mean, and I've never said this publicly, but, you know, things got to the point where I was offered, you know, like $4,000 a month from the government of Saudi Arabia by one of these individuals. And for a person who's in the situation I am, having lost his academic career and so on and so forth, right? I mean, it's no small amount of money. And, you know, I cut that guy off immediately after I was appalled. Unfortunately, I was sitting in the guy's living room and, you know, I had to get myself out of his home before I could sever ties with him. But one of these characters literally offered me $4,000 a month that he apparently could secure from the government of Saudi Arabia to, you know, pursue this delusion of regime change. And
that's an interesting partner to choose to work with, for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I had a lot of connections. I had interactions with several individuals in Mossad just in terms of, you know, communication about the crisis in the region. And, you know, I was someone who was seeking a change of government in Iran without any military intervention. And part of ensuring that that happens is to tell the Israelis, listen, sit down and shut up, because the Iranian people don't like this government. And the more you agitate against this government, the more you're going to lose potential allies you have among the Iranian population. So the best thing you can do is just lay off and let us, you know, carry out a propaganda campaign and effect a cultural revolution in the country. So I did have some, you know, dialogue with people in Mossad.
Interesting. Not really.
Point, these bastards came and offered me money, and I just cut them off like that. And these certain figures in the opposition yelled at me over this. It's like, what did you, why didn't you, you know, we would have, if you didn't want to take it, we would have taken it. And I was like, are you people kidding me?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, again, it's, if that's, you know, if I would assume that they would not be in a position where they were, again, I mean, the goal is destabilization. That's what I think. I don't think it is to build, you know, so, you know, coalitions or sure, at times they, I understand that they do that, but it's always to some kind of, it's always to another end, right? It's always another kind of agenda behind that or stuff. You know, you would, it would never work to work with those kinds of people.
I had an opportunity to get, at one point, a letter to the Israeli defense minister, and at another point, a letter to Prime Minister Netanyahu. And the gravity of responsibility involved in having the opportunity to, even if you know, no one even reads it, to settle my own conscience, to put on paper to these people, do not attack Iran. You know, there are a lot of people in Iran who are sympathetic to Israel, and eventually this regime will change, and those people will be your allies. And if you initiate a military conflict, you know, you're going to be undermining your own long-term strategic end. The opportunity there was too significant for me not to take. So, you know, I used the connections that materialized in order to get that message across. And I know that, you know, the Israeli defense minister read one of these letters, because when the coalition government collapsed in Israel, I don't know if you remember this, the coalition government collapsed in Israel, and Netanyahu personally took over the responsibilities of the defense minister in addition to being prime minister.
When was that?
It was like in last spring, I believe.
Was it that recent? Okay.
April or so of last year, I think.
Okay.
And when that happened, I was contacted and told to redraft this letter to Prime Minister Netanyahu instead of to the Israeli defense minister, which means that at least somebody in the defense minister's office read this thing and thought that it should be read by the prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
So look, I took those opportunities. That's one thing. That's diplomacy. I believe in diplomacy.
Sure. No, I get you. You're way too trusting. I would not have that faith in these people. Think that you could talk to them, you know, reason with them.
I'm willing to put my head on the chopping block to say that I communicated with people in Mossad. Look, I did it for the sake of peace.
Sure.
But
sure,
when these people come back and offer me shekels to be a shill for them, my answer is go fuck yourself.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously.
And I think that
I wouldn't speak with anyone else.
Yeah, that these people are going to commit treason in the Iranian opposition. They're committing treason by basically being so dishonorable and degrading their character and integrity to the point where they're willing to be shills of a government like the government of Israel when they are representatives of a culture as glorious and ancient as Iranian civilization.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me. It feels like it's something else going on there, to be honest, like it's some kind of setup or fraud or something to begin with. You know, that doesn't sound honest to me if they know if they truly understand what Israel is and what they think of Iran and the treatment of Iran and stuff.
Well, you know, I think it's entirely possible that, and it occurred to me at the time, that this was a setup so that I would be, you know, implicated as an agent of the Mossad or whatever the hell, and compromise connections to the right, and it would compromise the degree to which I have the ear of some people on the right.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it was too significant a chance at least giving them my two cents, and you know, being a voice for peace and averting this war that unfortunately has been initiated in the past.
Yeah, they didn't listen. And again, I'm totally with you. Of course, talking to someone is not a crime, or trying to reason with someone, obviously not. But again, I just know these people are unreasonable. You know what I mean?
But I'll tell you something that's interesting, and this may be interesting for your audience, is that the Israeli government is also not monolithic. And one of the reasons why I took these people seriously is that one of these several individuals I communicated with was on the very far right in Israel. And a bizarre thing about the Israeli political spectrum is that the further you get to the right of Netanyahu into some of these Orthodox Jews, they are actually favorable towards Iran, because in the in the Jewish Bible, in the Tanakh, Cyrus the Great is the only Goyim, he's the only non-Jew who is considered a Messiah of Israel, who liberated the Israelis, the Israelites from the Babylonian captivity and so forth. He's hailed as a Messiah, and he rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem. He's the one responsible for, at the cost of the Persian treasury, building the second temple.
Yeah.
So you have some of these more fanatical Orthodox people to the right of Netanyahu who actually would have been interested even in creating an alliance with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And you'd be surprised at the nuances in discourse, you know. But when the coalition government collapsed, that faction to the right of Netanyahu, which to some extent included the former Israeli defense minister, that faction was expelled from the Israeli government. And basically you got the Israeli neocon types consolidate control.
Interesting. I've never heard that. I didn't expect us to go into that, but that's very, very interesting. Some insight there. Very, very interesting, to say the least. Now, Jason, I want to make sure and let me know here if there's any more of these predictions you do want to go through before we get to it, but I do want to talk a bit about your book as well. We're going to round up here in a little bit. Of course, we could go on for much longer, but it's been a very interesting conversation hearing about, you know, your takes on this. And obviously, when it comes to predictions, always very difficult and always very hard, but what do you just a quick note on this, if you can. How quickly do you think? I mean, you have 2024 here in your prediction, so that puts kind of a time stamp on some of this. But in terms of speed and movement, how fast do you think some of these things will begin to unfold? Is it going to be quiet for a couple of months and then something else happens? Or is it going to be boom, we're straight into this thing?
No, it will not take a couple of months. I don't expect anything to happen tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. But I would say within weeks, we will see the Iranian retaliation, vast and vehement. And Trump, you know, with his mentality, will be very quick to respond to that. So I think within the next couple of months, we're going to be in a catastrophic conflict with Iran. Iran's periphery, Iran's proxies in the region. I think it will take not more than a couple of months for us to be in a really intense conflict, and that, you know, a year into the future, this will already be seen as a worse war by far than Afghanistan or Iraq.
Yeah, no doubt, absolutely. If this begins to unfold in this way, absolutely. Now, tell us a bit about Iranian Leviathan. We haven't had you on yet to talk about this, and maybe we can have you back here and actually go into some of the other aspects on the book, which is much more wider in scope than what we've talked about today. When did this come out again? Was it a couple of months ago?
This came out in September, and it is, as the subtitle suggests, a monumental history of Iran. And it's a monumental history, not just in terms of scale, but I'm using the term monumental in the specific philosophical sense with which Nietzsche employs it. Monumental history in Nietzsche's thought is a reappropriation of the past for the sake of the future. It's a kind of history that's not scholastic or antiquarian, that's not about, you know, eruditely ascertaining the truth about every detail of the past as if there are, you know, objective truths about history, as if there's anything like an objective perspective. Nietzsche recognizes that history is always written from a certain perspective and with the view to the development of a particular people, and with a view to furthering, you know, the trajectory of their culture. And so monumental history is a kind of archaeofuturist reappropriation of the past for the sake of future development. And that's the approach I've taken to the 3,000-year history of Iranian civilization in this text. I mean, it's a fairly, you know, thick book. It goes all the way from Zarathustra, from before Cyrus the Great, to the Islamic Republic. And if you want to understand the philosophical and historical foundation of the geopolitical position that I'm taking in the midst of this crisis, that's really the book to turn to. And, you know, you can get a taste of this book in two articles that I published on the Arctos Journal. If you just click on the one that is on Soleimani, the recent one, click on my name at the bottom of that, it will take you to an archive of my pieces published in the Arctos Journal. We're way at the bottom there.
There we go.
Two of them, Iranian Hegemony in the Islamic World and The Leviathan of Iranian Civilization. The two of those will give you a really good sense of what Iranian Leviathan is about.
And okay.
It's basically a vision of the renaissance of Iranian civilization and of Iran as a pole, a civilizational pole in a multipolar world order.
All right, very interesting. Of course, we have to, yeah, we have to have you back, and we can talk more about that in detail in another show, because that's too much to cover right now, obviously. But again, of course, I just want to have you back and talk about some of the personal stuff that's happened to you as well at some point. Hopefully, we can talk about that. I know you're, you know, in a very difficult situation, like many, of course, but particularly so. So, of course, if people want to support your work, that's one of the best ways I would recommend is to buy a copy of the book and help you out while you're doing what you can, you know, because it's been difficult for you. I know that, but I'm not going to speak for you. Whatever you want to share about that, maybe in the future show or something like that. But you do have a website, jasonrezagiorgiani.com, or people can go straight to arctos.com, of course. But you have a book section on your personal one that goes to Amazon, but people can go straight through Arctos as well. Let me go back to the book here as well, but. Jason, it was great having you here. So very interesting, some surprising twists and turns and stuff that we've gone into today that I both didn't expect, but it was interesting hearing about it, obviously. We appreciate your time. Anything else you'd like to leave us with before I let you go? I'm going to just close off with a couple of super chats outside, but I'll wrap up here with you first.
No, it was a pleasure to be with you again, Hendrik. I hope to have another such conversation very soon. And you know, there's another book that Arctos is going to be publishing relevant to Iran. I might as well mention that now. It is a study of the most widely celebrated 20th century work of Persian literature, the most significant novel written in modern Iran, The Blind Owl. I've written an exegesis of that, of The Blind Owl, a novel by Sadegh Hedayat, called Novel Folklore, which was originally published by Countercurrents, and it's going to be published in a new edition by Arctos within the next couple of months. That book also delves deeply into Iranian spirituality and really explores the possibilities for the future development of Iranian civilization. It also takes a kind of archaeo-futuristic approach to understanding Iranian history and identity. So that's something also to look forward to. Your viewers should look out for Arctos to publish that book within the next couple of months.
All right, great. Yeah, Arctos has a lot of good titles, so of course, so definitely check it out, folks, arctos.com. Again, I'll add a link to the Iranian Leviathan and those two articles down below in the description later. We, of course, repost this. It goes up on BitChute, goes out on Library, It is available streamed through VK and on Twitter and on DLive, of course, as well. But thank you, Jason, so much for joining us. It's great having you here. Just good talking with you again. It was a while ago, way too long ago. I know there's both of us have been through a lot, ups and downs and things like that. Censorship and ostracization from, you know, in your case, of course, workplaces and stuff like that. So I know you've had a rough ride, but keep strong, man, and keep doing what you're doing.
You know what Nietzsche says, that which does not kill us makes us stronger. That's certainly been the case for you. And I congratulate you on it.
Well, thank you. And same to you, Jason. Just stand tall, keep marching forward, and we'll get through this. You know, thank you so much for coming on today. Appreciate it.
Thank you again, Henrik. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Thank you so much. See you later. All right. There we go. There's Jason. Thank you, ladies. Oh, there we go. I'll just mute that in the meantime. And I wanted to just take a couple of super chats here before we wrap up, guys. I saw a couple of DLive Lemons, Ninja Guineas, and all that stuff came in. I thought we could just pass through that before we wrap up here for today. Great having you here. Of course, a lot of interesting things to consider as well with Jason Giorgiani. Let me do a couple of these here right away. All right, we got a couple of things here from Mr. Wright. Always a big supporter. He always donates a lot over on DLive. He gave a Ninja Guinea, no message, a diamond, no message. Thank you to you for that. JK160 diamond, no message. The Light of Decay sent a diamond. You can't hide, Mr. Pongren. Well, no, I can't. And that's why we do this show, you know, right in the open, on camera and everything. thank you for that. Mark Boggs gave a diamond. Says Project for the New American Century continues. Well, absolutely. And we kind of alluded to that a little bit earlier as well. It is, of course, tied into this aspect of the neocon agenda. We kind of went into that. Thank you, Mark. All right. Some people gave, lemons and ice creams and all that stuff. Thank you to all of you. I'm not going to go through all of that. It'll be too long. Shroon gave a diamond. Tired of paying for the Middle East. Well, absolutely. I mean, that's just how it goes. I think it should pull out altogether. Do not get involved. We've seen what a disaster that's been, both for America and for other countries as well. But again, as we know, that's not the agenda. That's not the goal, right? The goal is to meddle and destabilize. Shroon again says, gave a diamond and says, Middle East, we are never asked. Well, that's right. I mean, you know, whether it's war or opening the borders to Middle East and North Africa, we're never asked anywhere in the West if this is what we want, if this is what we support. You know, there are sizable war demonstrations, of course, when these things kind of do happen and blow up. Same thing in 2003. Not that it helped, unfortunately. But regardless, we did see a lot of people come out and they were sick and tired of this stuff. They didn't want the war in Iraq. And again, look, we were proven right, right? Showed the headline here too, from Foreign Policy Journal. I can pull that up again here. You know, we've talked about it before so many different times, but much of this stuff is built on frauds. Weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, all this stuff. Remember when, he was holding up Secretary of State Colin Powell, holding up the little jar of anthrax and dangling in front of the UN you know, delegates or representatives, I guess. Again, it was not an intelligence failure. It was a success. They gave out exactly the information that they wanted to give out in order to get the job done. And the job was to go into Iraq, destabilize it, and look at in the wake of everything that's happened. ISIS. You know, all this terrorism, of course, have driven more migrants out of the region. You know, some of these countries can fulfill, like Israel can fulfill their geopolitical goal in the region. And Europe and America are totally just flooded and invaded with migrants. They never ask us. That's absolutely right. Shroon gave a diamond, said, opposes New World Order misadventures in the Middle East. Absolutely. Thank you, Shroon. Kraut Vergnacht. Oh, God, it's too long, man. Kraut Vergnacht. That's how I think I pronounce your name. Team Foreskin Forever. Well, absolutely, sir. That's hang on to it, and don't let anyone take... if you do have a son, don't let them take his foreskin, because it's as the gods intended it. It's there for a reason, folks. Net Donna sent a diamond. Says good content. Thank you. We have some subscriptions were handed out as well. Thank you to all of you for that. And as always, of course, thank you to the mods over on DLive as well, to all of you guys. Norskbot gave a diamond, no message. Kraut Vergnacht says again, gives a diamond, says diversity equals enrichment, within quotes. homogeneity equals enrichment, or enrichment, actually, as I should say. Well, absolutely. Great. Thank you. Shroon Give a Diamond says, if we can't bear arms, why should we take part, I guess? Why should we be in a draft? Why should we be drafted? Well, exactly. Absolutely. Sway Guevara donated a diamond, says, in touch with Mossad, question mark. Yeah, that was interesting. It was an interesting turn of events. I didn't expect that. Jason has had a lot of adventures, meeting a lot of people, I guess, Mossad included, or meeting with, talking to them in some way. Very interesting. Didn't expect to talk about that. Jay Rudd donated a Ninjagini, no message. Thank you. Mr. Wright gave a diamond, another diamond, and another diamond, two more diamonds. Thank you, Mr. Wright. Always a big supporter. And I think that's about it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. We'll see what comes of this. You know, it's definitely predictions is always hard. It's always difficult. You know, are they going to pan out? How quick and stuff like that? It's always, we've talked about a lot of predictions over the years, but I do appreciate nonetheless Jason's perspective on it and sharing that with us today. Make of it what you will, and we'll see how much of that comes true, if the timeline is true or whatever. I think it could go really bad. I think this thing could, they've pushed for this war with Iran for decades now. That plan that Wesley Clark talked about with, you know, it's his Pentagon visit and all that stuff, General Wesley Clark, he was head of like the Europe division of NATO. And, I mean, they talked about Iran, and there was a 5-year period, and I guess someone jokingly said, as government does with everything, it's always like, you know, 10 years late, they can never do anything on time. But now we might be there. Now this might be the time that they're choosing to act on this and go in, and this has always been the agenda. So this might be the time, you know. It's absolute insanity, but it's also ironic, of course, that it seems like they'll be getting it with Trump, right? Which is the guy who ran on non-interventionism, America first, get out of these wars. That's what America wanted. That's what they voted for. They voted for a wall. They wanted to stop migration, yet it's more legal migration than ever into America. It's just all upside down. This is one of the biggest psyops that we've seen in recent times. And even the way they levied the reputation of the media to get this done has been very interesting to see. It means that they're willing to gamble. You know, because of that, the media has taken a big hit. A lot of, you know, a lot of credibility has gone down the toilet for the mainstream media. But it seems they're willing to risk that with Trump, and they pulled it off. So congratulations to you guys for doing that, because that was a smart move. Fooled a lot of people, and there's still a lot of MAGA people out there who are they're gung-ho about this. They love this. They think this is great. Trump could never do anything wrong. This is dangerous times, you know. But anyway. Guys, we're going to wrap up there. So thank you for joining us. Great having you here. We'll be back tomorrow with Weekend Warrior exclusively for Red Ice members. Go to redicemembers.com. Sign up for a membership there. That's the best way to support us as well. More interviews coming. A lot of more shows in the pipeline. We're working on some shorter videos as well, guys. But yeah, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed the show. Make of it what you will. But we'll keep monitoring this and keep covering this issue as well, of course. A lot of other voices that needs to be heard about this too. But guys, take care. We'll see you guys later. Thank you again for watching.